Season 4, Episode 33, Decoded Podcast. Clough, since our talk last week about conflict, I've been thinking about it all week. Conflict intersecting with leadership, intersecting with personal values, a lived experience. And then the ultimate for me has been just being open in a way that I've never really explicitly engaged in. It's been quite the week. It was a good week too, in terms of like work went well, family life was good. Lots of thinking on my part, but good thinking. It's, you know what it is? It's the stuff you feel is worth your time as an adult, right? It's like the thinking I'm doing now around those topics, I'm making myself vulnerable in order to grow. And I'm kind of really excited about the growth that's going to come from it, because it's not one of those things where you wonder, is there going to be growth here? There's going to be growth. And I think it's because of something you and I said on the on-ramp, that I'm explicitly and intentionally opening myself up and telling myself things out loud. Like, Roland, engage in this idea. Roland, don't be worried or scared about this idea. Roland, make the commitment to becoming a better person. And when I say that, it doesn't matter what's in front of me. It doesn't matter whether whatever's in front of me, I'm successful or unsuccessful. What matters is my commitment to me and my growth or my learning experience. When I do that, my mindset's completely different. I'm a lot more open to things. And even when I've been, like I told you, I've kind of been in that mindset, and I've even experienced it with my family, to the point where my family was kind of making fun of me the other day. And I literally was like, it's like an out of body experience. I stepped out of my body, because normally that would upset me. But I stepped out and I just looked at the situation, and it was so cool to gather some of the data from that experience, where I said to my wife, I said, isn't this interesting that like our youngest child, when criticized, even if like whatever, criticized positively, negatively, his first instinct is to fire back at me and criticize me about who I am. Like, kind of like, how dare you tell me not to act like this when you should see how you act? Mm. And it was very interesting, because I just stepped out of it. And I said, okay, you're right. I was looking at him, I said to my wife, is he ever going to give me room to grow in his eyes? Like, am I always just going to be one thing? Or will I wonder, it was a wondering. I wonder if he will ever let me grow to be somebody else in his eyes, which I can't control. All I can control is me. So at that moment, I laughed. I looked at my wife as my son was kind of like ranting about me based on something he had done. So not taking accountability for his actions, totally deflecting and entering into conflict, which I kind of had my arms open and said, okay, obviously you have something to say. So let's hear it and let's see what we can do. It was very interesting. It was a minute little experience, but fascinating to me as someone who came into it open.
I like the, actually, restart. So last week in talking about conflict, I feel like we kind of landed on a space that started rather abstract. Like it was safe and kind of abstract, right? And sometimes I think that's our topics, you know, we have the benefit of that. We can sort of remain in the abstract. You and I have our sort of insider. We talk about our on-ramp and our off-ramp. We've talked about the, you know, the fact that we hang out and we talk, not just when we talk on Saturdays like this. What I really like is when something abstract hits the ground and becomes a little bit more personal, and you start to be able to really notice, because the first sort of like noticing the thing, if you hang on just a little bit longer and suffer through a little bit of the ride on that, it ends up sticking with you for the week. And often some of the topics that we have on Saturday, that's what happens. We don't often return directly to a topic, but I feel like last week's episode started up. I felt like as soon as we got into our weeks, at least for me, it started to connect with a lot more places. Like it was sort of the noticing from our conversation led to a one step deeper to actual things happening in the week. It's funny. I think back. So way back in the day when this was probably, so Karen and I, we traveled to Europe. We did a European trip, 1999. And we grabbed a train pass and we stayed in youth hostels. It was fantastic. So we were gone from like late August till late November. And then we moved to Toronto. That's our, started our sort of professional life together. We were both done university. We decided to do the Europe trip. I can remember we were in, I think it was Genoa. So side note, best pizza ever. Like just, you want pizza? Go to Genoa. So we're in Genoa and we're going through these back windy streets. And of course we're, you know, it's time to eat. You're walking, you want to eat. We're constantly walking and eating, walking and eating. And we went into a pizza shop and the pizza in Genoa, it would say a number, and then I think par, like P-A-R, or maybe per. It was basically 100 per, or like $1 or $3 or €4, whatever it is, per etto, E-T-T-O. Now, North American style, you go to the pizza shop. What do you say when you want pizza if you walk in? What would you say? You say one of two things. If you're just going on your lunch, what might you say?
Could I get a slice?
Perfect. You set me up perfectly. So that's what I'm thinking. And I'm looking through my translator for slice. How do I order a slice of pizza? And somebody else was with us. And they're like, no. Etto means 100 grams. You don't order it by the slice. You order it by the weight. And I was like, by the weight? But then you think about it, that kind of makes sense. So, you know, what was funny was, I wanted a slice of pizza. If I wanted any foods there, my Italian was very rudimentary. So sometimes it was pointing. Sometimes I knew the words. Sometimes someone very kind, as I struggled through the words and my English, Italian to English dictionary was failing me, the person was like, oh, and they would sort of order it for me. They'd wave me off. And then there was all, you know, hugs and kisses and away we'd go. But I've never let go of that moment that, for me, it was about ordering the slice of pizza. Like that was my fluency. That's how I understood pizza. I understood it from the point of view as you walk in, you ask for the slice. My Western North American understanding. There, though, I started to realize that I probably could have found the word for slice, and I probably would have, but that could have been, you know, slice translation could have been something as big as my head. It could have been something small. Ultimately, they wanted to put it on a scale and sell me something by weight. And that's never ever let go of me about sort of the surprise that can sometimes be in the details when we're talking about the exact same thing. The exact same thing. Now, again, back to the pizza, one of the best ones I had there was like their white pizza, which had sliced potato and rosemary on it. It's fantastic pizza. Just props. I think it's called a Lucille or Lucia pizza, just if you're ever looking for a potato and rosemary pizza. That aside, I often think about that when some of the things you and I talk about, or when I encounter ideas within my week that I'm really curious about, but I'm only existing in the abstract layer of it. And I can get swept up in that quite easily without ever getting to the details and pushing on the details, pushing back on the details. It's hard. You can't push. I'm starting to realize you can't push back on abstract. It just becomes a ridiculous, you get two people talking abstractly about the pizza and it doesn't work. Can I do a paired text with this? I want to do a paired text just for a moment.
For it.
Because so here's the second story that's compared to that. So soon after that, we were back from Europe, and Karen and I were at, I forget where we were. Maybe down in Oakville, wherever, Brampton. Where's the other IKEA that's down Hamilton way? There's an IKEA down there.
Burlington?
Burlington. We're down in Burlington, and we stop at a Longo's. And we go up to the deli counter. I think I've told you part of this story before. We go to the deli counter, and I'm looking at the deli counter, and I'm thinking to myself, it was sort of kind of the beginnings of the, so this is like back in 1990. This is kind of back in the beginning when grocery stores, and probably a place like Longo's had this first, but where they were actually selling, you could go in, it's like, it's not just sliced meats at the deli counter anymore. You could get your chicken parm. You could get like prepared salads. Like there's a lot of stuff there. So you can bring home a prepared meal. So that idea of ready to pick up prepared meals being sold at the deli was still fairly new. I think that kind of came into play late 80s, early 90s. So I'm looking at all these salads. We're like, we had bought some stuff, I think, probably from IKEA, because, you know, just can't not go there and get something. But we go to Longo's, and I'm going past, and I'm sort of, okay, I want some of that, some of that, some of that. And Karen's ordering some stuff beside me. When I ordered it, you kind of had to say how much you want, pretty much like you're ordering sliced meat. Like you might walk up and say, I need a pound of thinly sliced honey ham or whatever. So I did very similar things. I got like a lentil salad. I think I got like a potato salad and something else. I got like three items, but each one I was like 150 grams. I'll take 200 grams of that. Now, backstory, right? Like I'm chef style. So I can visualize, despite my learning with the pizza, I can visualize a volume and a weight to a degree when it comes to food. Like there's certain things that I kind of have an understanding about, you know, how much volume would a certain gram weight be of something. I can kind of envision that a little bit to a degree. So I ordered my food and we sat down, and Karen got hers and sat down, and she's like, oh, do you want to share that? And no joke, I looked at her point blank and I said, I kind of wanted 150 grams of the couscous salad. I can't repeat the look that I got. You can only imagine the look that I got, because it was like, really? It was a little bit of that. It was like, you're an a-hole. It's like, aren't we not in that sort of zone in our relationship? And of course I gave up the salad. She's like, you're not happy, are you? I'm like, I'm happy. I'm happy. It's okay. I'm happy. She goes, you can always go order more. I'm like, yeah, I could. And then of course I'm measuring this through. I could. This is the alternatives that I have to sort of accept. The fact that I made a decision about the amounts that I wanted, and somehow I attached that to the logic, and somehow, you know, I think I like to connect these two texts, because on one hand, I was really amazed and sort of fascinated by the fact that this abstract concept could be broken down and ordered in a different way. Me using the tools didn't work out so great. Somewhere between is the learning of how do you sort of like maintain those okay, so just, you know, we're still married, we're good. This is like 22 years later, so we're good. But that story often pops up, and often people will say, like, why did you stay with the guy? Why would you stay with the guy? And she's like, you know, of course, she'll answer it from the mindset of what we've achieved since. She doesn't often stand there like, yeah, I was wondering. But she used to tell the story like that. Yeah, you know, like, that was a close one. Almost walked away. This past week, noticing conflict and seeing moments where I want to move down from the abstract. I actually do want to move into the details. I've also had a couple moments where moving into the details, I'm not very good at. Right now with the PQP that I'm completing, we're right in the thick of finishing up the course. So it just so happens that in the last quarter of this course, my projects that I have to deliver, and it's all with groups, are due. And it's kind of like one after another, set it up, knock it down, set it up, knock it down. And some of the conversations that I'm having, so this is all individuals, not all type A, but all individuals that are sort of exploring what it means to be a leader. On one hand, that can be really polite. That can be a really polite space. On the other end, it can be feral, where everyone's trying to sort of be seen and known. The real sweet spot in the middle is where it's freaking messy, because people are constantly kind of jumping in and then realizing they've stepped in it and then jumping out and then jumping in and then realizing that only two people are really paying attention to them. So they kind of like then have to find the person that's no longer talking to them. But I would say this past week, since you and I spoke, where I've constantly been stepping in it is where I've been test driving when I actually have. I said to you in the on-ramp, I want to go deeper and explore and learn more about navigating and engaging in conflict. I'm imagining that that's as much a pursuit of psychology as it is counseling, as it is sociology, as it is anthropology and psychology, right? Like, these are all the kind of factors that are kind of cracking off when you decide to step in and choose to disagree, when you realize you can disagree. And last week when we were talking about the bridge to harmony, even if that, I don't even know if I want to say that word anymore, harmony, maybe it's something, maybe the bridge to collaboration. Maybe it's less about this optimized version on the other side of conflict. Maybe it's just, that's where collaboration starts once you can get across. I don't know if collaboration is wrapped around it. Collaboration is the room. Conflict is the table. I don't know. I don't have a great metaphor for it. But yeah, this past week has been me stepping in it and me knowing the details. I wouldn't say it's helped me. I've made progress in some spaces. I've made mistakes in other spaces. I upset someone because I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I edged someone because I flat out said, this has to be done by tomorrow at a certain time. Because it did. We were sort of well past a deadline. I made it about, it must happen because of us, not because of, it was because I wanted to move on with other assignments and this was an anchor. I had finished my component of it. We had to submit it. And the other thing I'll just add into this before I got to start drawing something was that other piece. I forget when we sent it back and forth, and you and I have talked about the need to explain ourselves. And there are times I would say there are times as a leader or as a someone that's looking to engage in generative conflict, there are times where you might explain yourself. There are a little more dangerous times, I guess, if you dare to explain the issue between you, because that, I don't know. What do you think? It almost seems like it's safer to try and explain yourself than to do a point of clarification about the idea that's between your two, because someone will, like, don't tell me what this thing's about. Like, it's almost like people would rather, I think we'd almost rather take it on the chin ourselves by saying, here's what I think about deadlines, as opposed to this deadline must be maintained. But I've always felt like if you can sort of neutralize your ego a little bit and actually talk about the issue between you, that's a better form of conflict negotiation. But I have had people push back and basically say, you're edusplaining me here. Stop edusplaining. I've been stepping in it all week, dude. All week.
So then my question to you, first of all, you've got me cracking off in all kinds of different directions, but you've been stepping in it all week. Have you been stepping in it intentionally? Have you made a commitment to step in it because it's going to help you grow? Well, dude, so this is my perspective on what you just said. You've been stepping in it. What has been the purpose of you stepping in it? Are you stepping in it by mistake, or are you intentionally saying, I'm going to go step in that? Because yeah. I know I stepped in it on purpose a couple of times.
Yeah.
But I was stepping in it because I had to do it for me. I wasn't doing it to cause other people discomfort. I don't think I caused any discomfort. I think actually by me stepping in it, I think I made the world really comfortable for a lot of people this week. But you just said so much there. Like when you're talking about, you talked about collaboration is the bridge through conflict or something like that. I wrote down, it's the bridge to growth and understanding.
I think, yeah, I stumbled through that, but it was something like I was trying to understand, is collaboration the room and conflict the bridge? I think that's...
I'm now so hypersensitive.
Or the hallway. The hallway to right. It, maybe.
So in the on-ramp, you and I were talking. I told you that our talk last week about conflict led me in a number of different directions. Mm-hmm. One of which was truly to sit with conflict and to like wonder, what is it about conflict that I like or don't like? Okay. And I realized a couple of things. One of which is when conflict occurs in front of me, I get this funny feeling inside, right? Like the heart starts pounding, the blood starts moving pretty fast. It's almost like it's a fight or flight feeling I get. I want to neutralize that because it's not always fight or flight. And sometimes it's necessary to engage and to figure out what's going on, even if it means discomfort. The avoidance of the conflict because of what we've learned from our experiences of conflict. So for me, it's, oh shoot, there's something going on. My heart's pumping. That means that this doesn't usually end well. Somebody leaves upset. Somebody may very well leave upset. For me, if my intention is to enter into it in order for some growth to develop, then I'm in. I think for me, once I make the commitment, I'm committed. And for me, the issue is commitment. I don't think it's conflict. It's the commitment to the conflict. Like, am I willing to give this my all? Or am I willing to give this what it may require later? Because I don't know what the cost is going to be. So it's one of those things where you can have the pizza, but I'm not going to tell you how much you owe me until you're done eating. And if you're eating by weight, like, I'm in trouble because I love to eat. So it's like, no, really, can I have a slice? They're like, we don't do slices.
So the abstract doesn't change the actual amount. Sorry, understanding the details doesn't actually change your abstract concept. So when you think you're going to eat three slices of pizza, knowing the actual gram weight of it doesn't adjust the visualization in your head, so to speak. Like, you're still going to go for those three slices of pizza.
Right. So when I walk into that shop with you, I'm thinking, maybe we need to leave, Clough, because I don't know what my commitment is.
Interesting.
They might say to me, we don't have slices. We just create and we weigh it. And for some reason, they won't tell me the price, but they're like, just eat, and then we'll tell you how much you owe at the end.
Right.
I know I'm out of here. This is not going to be good for me. This is the same. I see now that you've told that story, I connect it to conflict. I don't know what the cost is going to be. So I either have to commit to entering in for the right reasons or commit to leave. It's one or the other for me. So this week I committed to entering into several areas that maybe could have become conflict, but didn't. And I was fully open and aware and told myself, I'm ready for this to go sideways, I guess. But you put something in front of me and it required action, but nobody wanted to act. So yeah. I committed to the action. I took leadership. Actually, this is the mix for me, right? With the conflict, leadership. I took leadership. I engaged. And I already told myself, whether this goes south or not, I'm engaging. This is a good practice for me. This is a good experience for me. This is a good way for me to build a different mindset. And it worked. It worked out. It was successful. So you bank that. You had success. But then I entered into another conversation where I think people have been avoiding conflict, but I'm tired of that now because I'm seeing the cost of avoiding the conflict. It's not worth the game. So for me to make it worth it to me, I need to bring the conflict to me. I need to open myself up to the conflict, engage in it, learn from it, and be very clear to the people involved that I'm not inviting the conflict to ruin relationship. I'm in fact inviting the conflict to build relationship and to improve myself.
So that's one of the spaces that's a challenge for me. So I would agree. I don't either. In the moment that you engage in conflict, are you skilled enough? And I think this is our use. And I, and maybe skilled isn't the right word. We're talking about like your social capital. Do you have the social capital that buffers the belief that you are actually trying to upset people? Now, let me kind of reshape this. I can remember there's this dude I used to work with that in staff meetings, he had a strong blurt factor. And sometimes it was radical. Sometimes it was illogical. Sometimes it was like offensive. Sometimes it was funny. And often someone would say, gosh, call the guy Mike. I wish I could sort of be like Mike. I wish I could sort of just say that. And, you know, people are kind of listening and he just kind of walks away from it. Now, I would say that's not leadership. You know, that's antagonism, right? I guess it could be perceived as leadership, but it's antagonistic. It's antagonistic to the group. You know, it dissembles. It's a little bit of anarchy. We're not usually used to talking back during staff meetings for the most part, right? So he's constantly talking back. So often people would say like, well, that's Mike. Like Mike can do that. I would never get away with that if I ever did that. I would never get away with that. How would you rate your social capital? And could you be Mike? Could you ever be Mike? Because what I love a lot about what you said, but one of the things that strikes me is that when you enter into conflict, one of the things that can help is someone on the other side of that conversation truly feeling and believing that you're not there to hurt their feelings. You're not there to insult them. Now, this can be about them and what they bring to the table. Everyone comes with biases, you know, like thoughts, feelings, philosophies, if you will. Are you skilled at managing that moment? Because I think that to enter into conflict in the spaces, education, life, you're going to buy a car. To enter into conflict, I think, is to do two things, is to recognize that emotions could be hurt. Three things. Emotions could be hurt in this conflict. Another thing, you have the skills to navigate that, to support that. Third thing, you have to be okay with the fact that, well, I forget the one of the four agreements. You know, the fact that you have to be okay with the ambiguity and the open-endedness of conflict. And I always forget, I want to say Don Miguel Ruiz's four agreements, but there's another individual that reshaped the four agreements. I got to look it up before the end of the pod, and reshaped it for when we engage in conversations about racism and racial bias. There's a four agreements there too. The heart of those two is being comfortable with that ambiguity and also accepting the fact that when you do speak up, you are intentionally going to be activating people's emotional states, whether it's at you or about the issue. Are you any good at that?
I don't know if I'm any good at that, but here's what I'm thinking based on your question. It's a great question. And I think maybe the more conflict we enter into, maybe the better skilled we become, if you can even use that word. But let me tell you about my last 2 weeks. So my last 2 weeks as a professional educator, I've engaged in focus groups with minority people in my school board, talking about a lot of difficult things. So there's been some really hard conversations over the last 2 weeks around people of color, LGBTQ, and Indigenous people in my school board. And then this Tuesday, there's another focus group for women, which I'll be attending as an ally. And along with those focus groups where we've been asked to share our voice around a census that's going to be happening in my school board. But that was only a small part of the focus group. Talking about the census questions and how maybe they don't pertain to certain things or ignore certain things, or maybe you should ask the question this way so that you're more inclusive of the people that are going to be answering these questions. That was a small part. The big part was people sharing their experiences and their voice around feeling not like not being seen, that they've not been seen, or being treated differently because of how they look or who they are. And these conversations have been very powerful for me because the whole thing's been about conflict. And to add, fuel to the fire, I participated in a leadership initiative in my school board that's totally centered on equity and diversity and inclusion. And I got to talk about my experience in my school board as a person of color. Those experiences, the leadership experience and the focus groups, have basically led me to a place where I've been speaking my mind a lot lately about things that I've never really talked about before. And at the heart of that is relationship. The people I'm talking to, and a lot of the people in the rooms, are people that I've built relationships with over the last 19 years. Many of them. Some of them I haven't, but it doesn't matter to me. Here's the funny thing. Here's the intersection. So a lot of the people in the position of power, I've built some kind of relationship with through committee work, through talking about my work, whatever, reputation. There's a positivity there. It's brought me to the point where I'm okay to say what I need to say about me because I've never said it before. And I've built relationships so people know, I think they know a good part of who Roland is and what Roland's about and what he values. And so now it's time for me to lean on that social capital to say, you need to hear what I have to say now because it's important. I think it's important and I feel it's worth me taking some of that social credit out of the bank now because I've invested a lot. So now I want some of that investment back. That intersecting with who I am today as a person who's engaged in some reading and some interaction with other people who have forced me to look at who I am as a person, as a teacher, as a human, it's all good. Like, I'm going to say what I need to say. I lean on relationship being important as we enter into conflict, but I'm also good at going into the conflict without a relationship. And being guided by my values, my experiences, and remaining open to what can come. I think for me, that mix, whether I'm skilled or not, I'm still going in. That's my backpack. I'm putting it on. That's what's in it. And I'm going in. And who gets to decide how skilled we are? The person on the other end of the conflict might think I'm a complete loser and I'm there to just cause difficulties. Well, they're going to think I'm not very skilled at entering into this. Or maybe they'll think I'm skilled if they leave feeling good about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. All I know is I've arrived at a place where it's time for me to speak. And sometimes I'm going to say things that's not going to sound very nice to people. Sometimes it's going to be shocking to them. Or they may take offense. My response to that would be, do what you need to do. But I'm telling you that I'm not here. I'm not here to make enemies. Right. I'm here to grow. I'm here to listen to you. But you're going to listen to me too. And if you don't want to, that's fine. You'll have to leave because I'm not going anywhere. I've got something to say. I'm going to say it now. It's easier to do that, I feel, with people that we have relationship with. In fact, this week, I leaned a little bit on that relationship in an email I sent my principal. My principal's a great guy. We're friends. He's one of my mentors. I'm learning a lot from him, but I'm also learning from him that I am not him. I am somebody else. And we talk. We have like leadership talks. And this week, it's a busy week, you know, and I emailed him. I said, listen, this is on my mind and I want to get it off my mind. I want to get it off my chest. There's no time for me to call you and there's no time for you to call me right now. Like we're working here. I just need to get it out so that it's out and you know it's there so that when we talk about it, it's not, I didn't lose any of it. It's all there fresh. And I sent him the email. And I don't think he's going to see it as me entering into conflict, but I think what he'll see is, and I think I mentioned it in the email, that I'm certainly open to the conflict that needs to happen. I feel like there are some things, not between him and I, but around other situations, we've gotten to the point where everybody's just being polite now and dancing around the conflict. Nobody's really engaging with it because they don't want to make that commitment because it could cost them something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling him, I think that if I don't enter into that conflict, I think I'm going to lose more by not entering into it. And I don't want to do that. So other people don't want to lose because they don't, because they're like, if I enter into this conflict, I lose. I'm going to lose something. I'm now standing around it saying, if I don't jump in, I'm going to lose.
Yeah.
So I'm in. It needs to happen. And it doesn't need to happen. It doesn't need to be a big blowout. That's the one thing that I realized a lot more this week after talking with you about conflict last week. It doesn't have to be a big blowout, negative, everybody hates everybody. It doesn't have to be like that. It simply, I think for me, means people have to speak their truth. They have to speak about what they're thinking, where they're coming from, why they're doing what they're doing, and then hoping that we can arrive at the end of it, we can arrive somewhere where people can walk away feeling like they're okay. You know, as a teacher, I've realized, and here's the other thing too. Sorry, dude, I hate to go on, but the other thing I've realized is with these hard conversations that I've been engaged in, there have been people sitting at the table that have power over me. And it's not cool and it's not fair to always be having courageous conversations with people who are not at my level, people who are over me or under me. So, like, let's talk about over me first. When I'm entering into a courageous conversation with a principal or a superintendent or a vice principal, I can say what I want. But at the end of the day, there is a power differential that is not equal. They have the power. Now, some would argue I have some too. I'm talking like on paper, legitimate, they have the power. If they tell me that they're going to do this to me or they're going to move me here, move me there, yeah, sure, I can have a conversation. I can tell them how I feel and why I don't think it's a good idea. We can talk about it. But at the end of the day, they make the decision, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. That's not cool. I'm sick and tired of people talking about courageous conversations and ignoring the power differentials that exist within them. Now, looking downward, you know, I have them with my students. Feeling this way these days, and I think as a teacher, I've always kind of been open to what people bring to the table. There are certain non-negotiables, and I tell my students and my parents that from a certain perspective, there are some non-negotiables as me being the teacher and them being the students, okay? But I ultimately get the last say. I'm ultimately responsible at the end. I get to make the decision because I'm the person that holds all the power.
Right.
And understanding that now puts me in a place where it's important to acknowledge that power differential. It's important to be open-minded and move from there. Stephen Hurley just asked in the comments, he said, you know, what makes a conversation courageous? And I think for me, what makes a conversation courageous is entering into a conversation where you know that there's a power differential and you might not be the one in power. And you know that there's something that needs to be aired in order for people to move on and build some harmony. That to me is what a courageous conversation is. And so when I talked about being a person of color in my school board, and I talked about not being seen in my school board, and I talked about being here for 19 years, and the school board down the street put out a tweet that spoke to me instantly, I knew it was time for me to start talking to people about that experience and how I felt and how we can change that experience for me and for others. And so that meant that I needed to talk to my administrators who have more power than me. That meant that I reached out to the superintendent of leadership in my school board and said, I have a positive professional relationship with, and said, can we talk about this? Because I've been here for this many years. I feel like I've got some leadership skills and I've got a lot to offer my system. And yet the system down the street tells me, look at all the supports we have for people that look like you. We could use people that look like you in our system. We need our students to have people like you leading our schools. Come see us. I said one tweet, and I'm in their information session learning about what they have to offer for someone like me. But my school board's never said that to me in 19 years. They've offered me opportunities to grow as a leader, but they've never once called me out as who I am, a person of color. They've never once said anything to the LGBTQ people that I've seen or to the indigenous folks. Nothing. So that was made it courageous, because I had to put my neck out there and I could say to my principals and my SO, I'd like to talk to you. And I know you have the power over me, but I've got something to say, and I think it will benefit the system. And I think it's certainly going to benefit me. If I'm going to stick my neck out there, I got to make sure that it works for me. And with this, it worked for me. And I've had those courageous conversations, and I'm going to continue having those courageous conversations. That's what makes a conversation courageous to me.
I think that question, again, it's abstract. It's like thinking about pizza. You drop into, you drop into any, let's say, PQP conversation so specifically about the courses. So these are individuals that are learning how to lead schools from the administrative chair. Okay. I think that depending on who's in the room, the composition of the individuals sitting there, you drop in, okay, today's topic, courageous conversations. From my experience, the starting point is that a courageous conversation is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to be wasted. And I don't mean you're intentionally doing that, as in we're trying to optimize this, as in these are the spaces we need to move into. One of the things that I think about, though, are, does everybody in the room have the same perception? So let's just say the opportunity. So we'll call it an opportunity instead of a courageous conversation. Does everybody in the room have the same perspective on what that opportunity represents? So I can speak from my white, middle-class, male, heterosexual position, that when it comes to, when I notice the opportunity, I don't have a lot of fear. I don't stop for a moment and I don't stop to think that this is likely, that I'm empowered by the fact that this is a heteronormative, white, middle-aged male opportunity. But it is. We still have the system that it is. And I think when with some of the writing and it even some of the, you know, the kind of pithy affirmational stuff that we see on social media about education is that often it's held in the fist of white supremacy. It's held in this space where we can call it opportunity because we can say no to it. We can choose to engage or not engage. Those courageous conversations, when they're not on the sort of edu-celeb or the, you know, the book junket tour, I don't know. I would wonder. So as you've kind of identified, as a person of color, the idea of being courageous, I think, holds different weight than me being courageous. Me being courageous is the assumption that I'm not doing my job if I don't step up. I wonder, for individuals of color, or maybe from your experience, if being courageous actually means you could be, your perception is that courageous actually makes my job in jeopardy. And I think it's a very different, there's two different conversations going on when we talk about courageous conversations. There's the privileged one and the entitled one, where we're somehow not rocking the director's plan somehow. And then there's the other one where, oh, you were talking to me. You want me to engage in this courageous conversation? You got to make my space safe first. This has to be safe. This space has to be fortified for me to be in there. You and I have talked about this before. We like the idea. You know, head nod to Pam Agua for this one. We want co-conspirators in the world in the room. We want people that are going to step up, and we want the conflict of interest. We want these are her words speaking from her center, saying that when she enters into these courageous conversations, she doesn't want to be the only one that's actually truly demonstrating courage. I don't know, for white folk, generally speaking, I don't know for white folk if courageous conversations are actually demonstrations of courage. I think we like the title on that. So I appreciate Hurley's, you know, question. But I think at the heart of this, it's two different conversations. One of the things that I think I'll speak again from my experience, and this is something that I'm working on, is that one component of the courageous conversation is your ability to stay in it. And you don't get to sort of pro forma ahead of time, say, here I go, I'm about to go into a courageous conversation. You just sort of recognize it when you're in it, and you stick in it until you figure out where you're going to come out. And I'll go back to those four agreements. As soon as I stop, you know, ranting, I'll find the four agreements, because they, I think they speak to the other side of the conversation, that if the individuals that really do feel that they're demonstrating courage in these conversations, and asking others to be courageous as well, I think that's very different than the book titles of being, you know, entering into courageous conversations. See, I even did the voice, right? Like that's it. Do you feel courageous? And for you stepping in, do you have a sense of courage? I almost want to use the word peril. Like, I wonder if that is the litmus for whether or not the stakes are as high as we humble brag about. That you actually have to have a sense of either occupational peril. I hope not physical peril, but others might feel that sense of physical peril. You talked about stepping into these conversations. I would agree. If I perseverate too long on the fact that, oh, I've just been avoiding this topic, I've been avoiding this topic, I got to have this conversation, I talk myself into a nervous state. I can feel my heart, a little bit of sweat, maybe a little bit of sort of like the tingle up and down, breathing kind of changes. You have a physiological change. But I enter into the conversation. I'm like, okay, I got this. But I wonder about the individuals that state continues. That fight or flight state continues through the whole conversation. I'm trying to imagine how dangerous the courageous conversation can feel for someone. And I don't know if that's, way too abstract. I haven't been a part of those conversations as often as I would like to be, the conversations about that.
My recent experience with the focus groups in my school board has been really awesome from my perspective. I emailed a principal that I talked to about leadership. She's been attending them as well, because she's a leader in the system, and she's part of the leadership framework to help build leaders in the system. And she's been attending these groups, and I emailed her after the second one. And I said, like, how can people not leave feeling compassion for other humans when they hear these stories, when they hear, when they hear people come out and are courageous and share, disclose something about themselves? How can you not, my perspective, how can you not be compassionate of this, of the courage of somebody's lived experience? And as a person who feels, how do you not feel like, oh my God, this person is experiencing this, or they feel this way?
I think it's the peril. I think it's the sense of peril.
It's the vulnerability for sure as well. Be vulnerable like that is friggin' powerful. And I'm not going to lose my job over being a person of color. I'm not. But, you know, the LGBTQ community in a Catholic system, you could lose your job over certain things. And, you know, that gets me at the core, that there are people walking around who aren't disclosing who they really are or how they feel because they would be in jeopardy of losing their livelihood, you know. That upsets me.
Like, yes.
As a human, that upsets me that good people, and when I say good people, I'm like people who have positive reputation, people that I've worked with, people that I know of who are doing good work. You know, they don't want to say who they are because they're fearful that they're going to lose their job. And they do a good job from what I can see. That gets me.
Can I drop into just, because otherwise, is it okay if I just, I want to just hat tip to that four agreements, the yes. Courageous Conversation. So that's Glenn Singleton. I knew it's popped up in a few of my PD sessions. It's the framework for, in this case, four agreements for courageous conversations. But again, these are courageous conversations that are angled towards working through racial bias and the power structures that reinforce that. So there's four, just quick. It's stay engaged. You're invited into dialogue, and everyone does have the opportunity for free speech, but you're expected to stay connected to the conversation. Expect to experience discomfort. So this comes along with talking about things that either A, we don't have full grounding in, B, we don't have full, so grounding as far as understanding, grounding as far as emotionality, grounding as far as lived experience, but you know, to stay with it. So we kind of default to stay one, stay engaged, even if you're just uncomfortable. Speak your truth. You speak your truth. And this kind of, again, falls back into the dealing with discomfort and staying engaged. And finally, at the end, that these conversations, they by nature are not going to be closed when you walk away from them. They're meant to be sticky. They're meant to stay with you. They're meant to have a lack of closure to it. So Don Miguel Ruiz has a similar framework, but this one is specifically angled towards the idea of courageous conversations. And quite directly, many of the PD sessions in the last 2 years, especially around anti-Black racism, we also have, this has popped up as well as anti-Semitic bigotry within my school board, that these four. Here's the thing that I just want to close with this, though. This list, I think, is written for white people. I think the list is written for individuals for whom privilege is the platform from which they see courageous conversations. So I think they're great rules, but I also think, just like Kendi's book, How to Be Anti-Racist, that was kind of for white folk too. The dominant power holders, let's start with that, many cases happen to be white folk and the systems that reinforce their power. So that was my Glenn Singleton. Props to him. Props to the people that are engaging with that. I can shoot the link off to you. Have you seen that one before? Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I'll share I'll share it with you.
Right on. Thanks.
No, you're welcome, dude.
I want to close up what I was saying before you jumped in to give Glenn Singleton a hat tip. For me, it was important to have allies and supporters by my side.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like from that, I've springboarded into not necessarily needing that, because I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. I think I've been, I think my admin team has done a good job of building trust and relationship with me from the top down. And so it was really easy for me. It was really easy for me to say to them, hey, guys, sorry, I shouldn't say that. Hey, guy and gal, because my vice principal was a female.
Hey, folks. Hey, folks. Hey, folks.
Hey, folks. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, for me to say to them, hey, listen, I just saw this tweet. I'm going to attend this session. And I really want to, I want to debrief with the both of you after it. And I'm going to let the SO know after of what I learned, because I have something to say, and people need, you need to hear what I have to say, because, you know, it was funny. The main thing I said to them was like, look, we make fun of Twitter. We make fun of social media all the time. I'm like, but this little thing we make fun of just caught my attention and is holding it really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, let's ignore the jokes around this thing for a minute. This medium has caught my attention. This school board has me exactly where they want me. I'm willing to give my time up to hear what they have to say. And it's all because they just reached out and spoke to me. I said, guys, gal, this is
folks.
Folks, this has not happened to me the whole time I've been here.
Yeah.
This is not cool. So what are we doing wrong? Or what are they doing that's really good that like sits well with me? So anyway, I have allies. I have allies in my school. I have allies in my school board. And I've built relationships. So for me, it's funny because for people be like, oh, well, Roland knows people. Yeah, but it took 20 years to get to know people. Like, it's not like I just woke up and started talking. And there are people like that. There are people who I admire their courage and their need or want to engage in these conversations without having built any relationship. I'm not saying that you have to have relationship. I'm saying it certainly helps. Mm-hmm. In my situation, it's helping me. But again, like, I played the long game. Like, I've been building relationship for 19 years or and less in some situations, because I haven't, all the people I talk to, I've not known for the full 19, but
yeah.
But anyway, so allies are good. I think though, you have to learn how to go your way without allies in your corner all the time, because you may walk into a room where you have no allies or support, and you need to step up and do your job, speak your truth, enter into conflict in order to grow, in order to make things better. It's good life lessons. The one weird thing is I wish that it didn't take me 44 years to get here. But on the other hand, that's how life goes. I remember being a younger teacher and talking to and listening to the 44-year-old teachers and thinking either this guy's nuts or, wow, I hope that one day like I will have that kind of wisdom. And I'm not saying I'm wise, but what I am saying is that the 44-year-old Roland is certainly a lot more mature and a lot more seasoned than, you know, the 27-year-old Roland, for sure. And I still have a lot to learn, but I'm just tired, I think, of I'm tired of not engaging. So I'm looking at commitment. I'm looking at what is it about commitment that keeps me from committing? And then what are the conversations that I need to have the way I have them with people to move things forward? Because, you know, it took a couple of initiatives to get people rolling, but I feel like now my school board's setting itself up really nicely. We have an equity officer now. My school board just hired a black vice principal. We had one black principal in our system for many years, but this principal left our system to go become a superintendent in another system, which left us with no black administrators. So my school board just recently appointed a black vice principal who will be vice principal at my school after next week, I guess. I'm excited about that. So, and we're having these conversations about equity and inclusion. So, you know, I feel like some people are mad that we're not moving into action quick enough. My perspective is, hey, we're having the conversations. People are listening. We're working on building policies and procedures to help us move forward. And I think that's a start. We need action and we're getting action. So that's good. We just got to keep it rolling and keep the conversations going and keep building relationships, right? Like we talk about relationship all the time. Keep building relationships. Keep being as vulnerable as you can be. Keep speaking your truth. And I believe we can do that respectfully. I really do. I think we can do that respectfully. That's all I got for today, Clough. Thanks for
you know the what show. I love the you know, as soon as you talked about wisdom, I right away went back to you and I playing Fortnite yesterday and us in the chat talking about how our strategy in Fortnite was a wise strategy and talking about, you know, wondering it. Because when you're playing, when we drop in and we play against other individuals, you never really know the age of individuals, right? But I'm starting to notice a pattern in how you and I play. We search around in some of the cities, we grab a vehicle and we drive around a little bit. It's like we're not hustling. We're not hustlers in the game. It's like we're playing our midlife selves in the game, right? We grab, you know, what seems to be where we sort of sneak in and out of buildings. We don't construct much. Like we don't stay and fortify. It's just throw the chonkers on anyone out there Fortnite, throw the chonkers on the Lambo and away we go. And we just cruise around for a little bit and then drive up the side of a mountain and wait at the peak and watch everyone else kind of scramble around to the bottom. So that was my brain. I'm like, yep, we're wise. That's the wisdom. That's the wisdom of gaming, playing video games as a almost 50-year-old. Me, I know you're not there yet, but.
Yeah, I was going to say, speak for yourself, bro.
I'm totally speaking for myself, totally.
It's funny how you would talk about the gaming, though, because it is interesting how we approach our strategy.
Dude, anyone out there listening, the fact that you and I are just getting in a car and driving around,
popping out everyone. Awesome.
You know what it is, but it is kind of like the middle age. It's someone's going, there's a couple middle-aged men driving around in a Lambo, right? It's like the midlife crisis car, but we're using it in Fortnite.
Right.
With off-road tires.
And what's really funny, so if people could picture this, so you and I, we generally chat, right? Like sometimes you'll call me on my cell phone or we'll text or we'll send a direct message in Twitter. But when we're gaming and we get in the car and we start driving around this made up world, avoiding conflict until the end to try to win the game, you know, we're literally chatting about all the things that we'd normally be chatting about, except we're doing it in Fortnite in a Lamborghini with big wheels on it and driving up mountains and stuff. It's actually, now that you say it, it brings a smile to my face to think about how we operate within a video game as middle-aged men. It is kind of funny. And sometimes
we identify as middle-aged men in the video game. Yeah, we're not looking. And the other funny thing is, like, both of us saying, yeah, we're not going to bother with skins. We're just going to be who we are. We're going to earn all of our upgrades. We're not going to pay for stuff. I'm not dropping any money on V-Bucks.
So, okay, this is funny. I'll drop this before we go. But okay, so for anybody who doesn't know Fortnite, I appreciate that because I didn't really get into it until I bought my new computer and Clough said, hey, do you play Fortnite? And I'm like, no, my son plays and I never really got into it.
But I hadn't either. That was the thing. Okay. I had neither. Yeah.
So whatever, I get into it. And for all these years, my oldest has been playing and he constantly wants me to pay for him to purchase stuff in the game. And so, okay, if we can, you got to take a look at the screen, Chris. Look at what Ramona has said. We've got Ramona crying, laughing right now. Okay, Ramona, well, I'm going to add some more for you to laugh and cry about. So my 14-year-old son's been playing Fortnite for a couple of years, and he's always like, I need money. I need V-Bucks is what the currency in Fortnite. Can you buy me some V-Bucks? I'm like, what for? Whatever. So over, you know, special occasions, we'll get him a gift card or something. Mm-hmm. We've spent hundreds of dollars on V-Bucks. So the one day when I actually decided to pay attention to him, I'm like, okay, so where do I go? Now remember, I'm a middle-aged man, right? I don't need to buy outfits. I don't need to buy clothing. I'm like,
we recognize they're cool. We do appreciate the skins. There's some pretty cool. And for those that are listening, skins are just like all clothing. It does is it. Yeah, it's costumes. Costumes. It changes who you can't do much with your avatar unless you actually pay. Like you.
Right.
And we're just like, nope.
So I say to my son, so I'm a middle-aged professional. I bought myself a really nice computer that can handle this stuff. Where do I go to pay for all the weapons and the vehicles that I'd like to buy? And my son's like, you can't buy weapons and vehicles. You can just buy clothing, costumes. And I'm looking at him like, are you friggin' kidding me? Who would want to buy all these costumes? And now he's looking at me like, Dad, you are such an old man. So Clough and I have the most basic, we have the costume that they dress you in when you start playing.
Yep.
And I'm not paying a one red cent to buy a costume. But if they told me I could buy weapons and vehicles, I'm in, because that's actually going to help my game. But oh my God. So people, the 12-year-olds who are wearing the most awesome costumes are probably looking at us like, oh, look at these two guys who don't know what they're doing. Oh, that's the other thing too. Sometimes they change your gender. So sometimes I'm a basic man, or I'm a basic woman. Sometimes I'm a woman with blonde hair. Sometimes I'm a guy, a big dude with a cool beard, whatever. But we're wearing the basic outfits. And they probably look at us and think, these guys, I'm going to get these guys. And then we end up winning the game because they're 12 and they don't know how life works yet. So
we hop in the car, drive away. Props to all the 12-year-olds listening to our podcast. We're not throwing any shade your way, my friend.
That's hilarious, eh? They don't even know we exist. In fact, one time I was playing recently, and when I play by myself, this is my wife's biggest pet peeve. She's like, are you seriously playing with 12-year-olds? I'm like, stop and listen to me, honey. I don't know who I'm playing with. I don't use my mic when I play with when
me
I
neither, play solo.
I don't talk to people. I just I listen to the music that's playing while I play or whatever. But it's hilarious because I'll be playing and I'll hear somebody be like, hey, Jimmy, come over here and check this out. And it's literally like a 12-year-old who's like killing in the game.
Yeah.
And I'm 44 is over here. 44, that's what I'm going to call myself. 44 is over here like, oh my God, I wish I could build a structure as fast and as well as that 12-year-old. But
well, it's funny. That's like, it was even our conversation last night when we were spectator, like, man, look how fast that person can build. That's some skills. So we see it. But watch out, 12-year-olds. We're learning.
Watch out, 12-year-olds, because this 44-year-old has a Lambo with big wheels on it, and I've got an arsenal of weapons. And
this 49-year-old loves hiding in bushes and waiting for you to walk by.
Ramona, Ramona's dying over here in the comments. She's like, look at this. She's literally like, Ramona's having a field day here.
Ramona's got to get it. She's got to get in our squad. We got to squad up. Matt Oldridge, you too, buddy. You too. You said you'll play. Come on out. Let's squad up one night.
So as Ramona's listening to our conversation, laughing, cooking her turkeys, which I just picture Ramona roasting turkeys all the time. Ramona, we'll have to talk to you off the podcast because there are some things we can't say. But Chris and I had a really fun experience yesterday. Remember yesterday, Chris? Where we were both in a room and this person walked in.
Yeah.
And it was, 44 and 49-year-old.
Don't cage us in.
Just say that. Ruining a 12-year-old's night. That's what we did.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Here, this is what I got to
today. Yeah. What did you draw today? Oh, tug of war? What's that stand in the middle? Explain it to me, Clough.
A little bit of a balance.
Got you. It's a balance. Okay. And there's people falling off on each end.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good. Can we help them?
can they help themselves?
Will they be courageous and tell us that they need help as they're falling off the end?
This is a good convo today. I liked it as a follow-up. This was cool.
Thanks, Clough. This was season 4, episode 33.
Hard to believe, eh?
Yes and no.
Hard to believe.
Okay, dude. Have a great week. Have a great weekend.
Peace, man. Yep.
See ya.
Chats.